We will consider the first order of business, which is SB 54. There is, that was a typo in SB 54. I think we'll, first of all, let sponsor, representative of the Labor and Commerce Committee. If someone here wants to talk on this, or we will just proceed then. I will try to explain the difference, or the typo correction. As you'll notice, the original, on page, on line 14, had before we get into that, let me note who's here. Senator Duncan, Senator Phillips, Senator Lehman, and myself, Senator Sharp. The CS corrects a drafting error, which would, the CS deletes the word "and" on page 14. And also, deletes "served by" that was left in on the original bill. Apparently that serves the intent of the legislation and makes sense. Other than that, that's the only comments I have on it. We do have in the folder letters of statements from Marika and some suggested changes from commercial refuse and Anchorage. We have on line in Anchorage to testify, I'm told, Jim Arneson and Jimmy Jackson, representing GCI here in. In Juneau, we have Dave Hutchins, who has signed up to testify. With that, I would go to Dave. You want to testify first? Present time.
Both some telecom. Do they have a time limit? Time constraints?
Today, here's my intentions today, is to hear as much testimony as suggested, possible changes for this, and we'll, committee will accept input from people testifying on possible changes. We will then work on incorporating as much as possible into a CS that will resurface next week. Give us time to digest some of the recommendations, and then we'll proceed at that time forward. With that, I would ask Mr. Hutchins to proceed with his testimony or comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Dave Hutchins, Executive Director of the Alaska Rural Electric Cooperative Association. I thank the committee for scheduling this bill for consideration, and also thank Senator Kelly for introducing it. The basic regulatory system at the EPUC is for the utilities to have discrete, separate service areas where the utilities, particularly the electrics, that's all I'm really speaking for, are most efficient when they are natural monopolies. And in lieu of competition, then, the system is that the PUC regulates the services and rates of the utilities, unless in some cases the consumers are able to vote to opt out of regulation. And the separate service area provision comes from Section 221 in the PUC statute. And it's been there ever since the commission has existed in its present form. The factual situation that existed when the commission was created and 221 was adopted was that the electric utilities were in a competitive environment. They, any of the electric utilities that were located within the same communities competed fiercely. It was a wasteful use of resources and did not work very well. As a result, the commission was created, and Section 221 directed the commission to separate the service areas. And that job of separating the service areas is essentially completed now. We discovered one case a year ago that where the inadvertently the utilities were still overlapping and didn't even know it until recently. But essentially that job is completed. The purpose of this bill then, as it is before you, would be to direct the commission to keep the electric service areas separate. And the reason we think that is necessary at this time is that there is a national trend, which we frankly recognize is going on out there. It's on the electric side of things. It's referred to as retail wheeling. And that may or may not work in some areas. We are absolutely convinced that it would be disastrous in Alaska. It would put us back in the same old situation that we were before. And perhaps worse than that is that in the smallest communities, where the little electric utilities are always struggling to try to achieve and maintain economies of scale to where they can hold the rates down, if some independent power producer were authorized to come into the community to compete for the large customers in the area, it would force the rates for the other consumers, the residential consumers and small commercial, to go up. And in some extreme cases, you might even destroy the feasibility of providing central station electric service for all consumers in the area. This is the fear that we have, the reason we think this bill is necessary, and we do ask for support of the committee for this policy determination. Section 1 is simply a clear statement of policy, which would be a new subsection in Section 221, which simply recognizes the changed circumstances that have occurred since 221 was originally adopted a long time ago. Section 2 of the bill would remove this language "and presently or formally served by" to bring Section 990 into conformity with the amended 221 with the Section 1. And just by way of historical background, this language that you see in Section 2 of the bill was enacted a number of years ago, and it was sort of a compromise that no one was terribly happy with at the time. And the situation that produced it no longer exists. The situation at that time was that the electric utility and the gas utility on the North Slope were fighting each other fiercely. The electric utility was using diesel to generate their power rather than buying gas. And in their marketing plan, the gas company was trying to go to industrial customers, get one to put in a generation plant to sell electricity to his surrounding neighbors. Only one such customer ever actually did that, and he's now out of business. In conversations with the gas company recently, operations manager there, he tells me that they have no intention of going back to that old marketing system, that it didn't work, and they've abandoned that approach. So that was an issue that no longer exists, and we'd like to bring that section into conformity with the policy statement that we're proposing for 221.
Mr. Hutchins, do you agree that the wording change in CS is required to?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I do.
The original Canada legislation. Okay. Any questions from committee members? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
This time we'll go to the teleconference. We have first signed up Jim Arneson. Are you there? Please state your name and who you represent, okay, and proceed.
My name is Jim Arneson. I'm a businessman. I do business as commercial refuse. I haul commercial refuse here in Anchorage. My but Mr. Chairman and committee members, I'll attempt to keep my testimony short today because I've already provided ample information earlier. Basically, if I were to outline what I'm looking for, is I'm looking for either full or partial deregulation of the refuse industry. The main reason for that is the refuse industry does not possess the characteristics of a natural monopoly, which would indicate a need to protect such an entity. I'm looking to change the exemptions before one becomes regulated. In the event that deregulation is not in order, then I'm looking to change the exemptions that are found in AS 4205-711, where if you have over $200,000 in gross receipts, you have to be regulated. When that language was adopted many years ago, the dump fees were averaging about $5 a ton here in Anchorage. Nowadays, at $45 a ton, obviously the cost of business has gone up all of us. So I'm looking to increase that exemption to at least $2 million. I'm looking for a change or an addition in AS 4205-990-I3A, a group of 10 or more customers that purchase a service or commodity furnished by a public utility. I'm looking to add a sentence to that, or in the case of a refuse utility, a group of 100 or more commercial customers, or a group of 3,000 or more residential customers that purchase the service of a commodity furnished by a refuse utility. And what is sorely needed at this point is also a definition of the word customer in the statute. In AS 4205-990, there is no definition for what constitutes a customer, and that is one of my biggest problems right now. There are definitions provided for customers in the Alaska Administrative Code found in 3 AAC 52340 and 52500, which are definitions of customers for electric and the telecommunications industry. I'm looking for that same definition to be put into the statutes as it applies to refuse. And basically, I think I'll leave it up to any questions right now. I hope that the committee will seriously consider some of the concerns I have raised and hopefully make some amendments or act something on to SB 54 to address some of these concerns. If there's any questions, I'd be glad to answer some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Arneson. Any questions from committee members at this time? No, not this time. We will further examine the correspondence that you have in there. I think you referred to the specific statutes in your testimony as well as in the correspondence we have in our files. So, as I mentioned earlier, we will be revisiting this and seeing what kind of accommodations the committee chooses to make on broadening the bill from if they do wish to do that, from electric utilities into the other general utilities or not. But I do appreciate your information. Senator Phillips has a comment or question.
How many certificates are issued for refuge hauling in the Anchorage area?
The Anchorage area right now, the municipality of Anchorage has a certificate. Anchorage Refuse Incorporated has one. Eagle River Refuse Incorporated has one. And those two are basically one company. Anchorage Refuse owns Eagle River Refuse. And Peninsula Sanitation has a certificate, but they're limited in scope to down in the Indian and Girdwood area.
So basically what you're asking is deregulation of the certificates?
Yes. Some sort of deregulation, either partial or total, and I'm a little cautious about asking for total deregulation. I've applied for a certification in the event that deregulation doesn't come about. Okay. Although I find it very difficult to operate under the regulated environment as a small operator, And my operations right now are strictly commercial in nature, and I serve under 10 customers, in my opinion, although recently the commission came out with a ruling that a customer is equal to a location. So I don't know if I'm in a position, depending on what they mean by location, I'm either operating legally or illegally. And I only serve presently 4 or 5 entities. When I talk about an entity, for instance, Safeway is one customer. I contract with headquarters, I send them the bill, they pay the bill. But there are 6 stores. So does the commission ruling mean that each location is a customer? And when you talk about Costco, that's another, I consider them one entity, but they have 2 locations. I deal with their headquarters in Kirkland, Washington. Send them the bill, they pay the bill.
Yeah, Mr. This is Randy Phillips again. Still trying to understand. Obviously, I don't know enough about this to make an informed decision. So that's why I'm asking these questions. You are currently serving just commercial operations right now, right?
Yes.
Okay, and the other guys, meaning Anchorage Refuge and Peninsula and Eagle River Refuge, are they also doing commercial operations as well as residential?
Yes.
So, therefore, if you asked, you probably, if we deregulate this or do what we're asking, we're probably going to hear from the other guys, right?
Oh, most definitely.
Yeah, I figured that.
If you chose to deregulate, it would turn into a real circus.
Okay.
But there might be some other avenues you could look at, like, for instance, put in that definition of customer, increase the number of customers a person can have before they have to be regulated. Increase the exemption before one becomes regulated.
Hey, do you know that, it's Randy Phillips again, do you know, these suggestions you're referring to, which is on page 4 of your letter to us, do you know if the other guys are going to object to this?
Sure.
And if they do, for what reasons?
Well, I think they would object to it, and the main reason is they don't want any competition.
Okay.
You know, when you're a regulated utility, you have a guaranteed profit. You operate on cost plus, and basically, these regulated entities never saw the opportunity for somebody to come in like I did and enter the business. My options were to either enter the business under the so-called loophole of serving less than 10 customers, so I picked the 10 best. Or went after the 10 best, or less than the 10. They never thought anyone would try that. My option would have been to go down and spend $300,000-$400,000 and apply for certification and fight them off the bat without even going into business. And if that were the case, the customers of this town still would not have any lower price services available.
Okay.
So I chose to go ahead and go into business under the exemptions and not be regulated, and while I applied for certification, I could continue to operate and earn a living and provide the customers some benefit.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Senator Lehman.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Arneson, this is a big step. You know, philosophically, I'm with you. I've discussed this with the waste haulers in the years past. And I know what their arguments are. I'm not so sure we're going to want to do this on this bill, but I guess that's something. It's maybe as good a vehicle as exists. But I guess I just want to say, Mr. Chairman, that I'm willing to take a look at it and see how we can craft something that makes some sense so people like this guy can operate in business and we can continue to serve the public well.
Any other comments?
We
will, I don't know if I mentioned before you got here or not, we will be holding the bill and considering suggestions and what the committee wants to do on expanding the bill or not. So Senator Phillips.
Jim, this Randy Phillips again. This is more a curiosity question than anything. How did you hear about this piece of legislation? Because frankly, I was a little surprised at your letter in our packet. Nothing personal, but I was just, you know, surprised about it.
Well, I've tried to keep up on everything that's happening, and I came down here to the LIO and started doing some research. I found a bill that said something about refuse on it, and if you look at your computer printouts, in reference to SB 54, it talks about refuse in addition to electric utilities, so immediately I jumped on it.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions?
It was your benefit, Jim. I didn't have to answer.
Any other questions of Jim Arneson? Thank you, Mr. Arneson. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Next, we have signed up in Anchorage on teleconference is Jimmy Jackson. Good afternoon.
Thank you. Good afternoon to you. My name is Jimmy Jackson, and I am the attorney for GCI. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. This bill does not directly affect GCI, but GCI is pro-competitive, and we believe that it is in the public interest to maintain the possibility of competition in all utility markets. Therefore, GCI is against this legislation, and particularly Section 1 of the legislation. First point is that the bill is unnecessary. The APUC has ample authority to prevent any competition that would be harmful. Anyone who wanted to go into competition would have to go to the APUC, apply for a certificate. That's the process Ms. Arneson just described as a $300,000 or $400,000 process, I think. They would have to prove to the commission that competition would somehow be good before there could be any competition. The track record of the commission has been to introduce competition very reluctantly, very carefully, and not to throw open the doors to harmful competition. So this is not necessary. It's also harmful. 15 years ago, when you went to national utility conferences, people were talking about the possibilities of long-distance cell phone competition. I think we know what happened in that area. The existing carrier in Alaska tried to prevent it. The citizens of Alaska were denied the benefits of competition for a very long period of time. And then it was finally dumped in your lap by people demanding that competition be allowed, not demanding that it be prohibited. Today, when you go to such conferences, people are talking about competition in other utility areas, including electric and including local telephone. That's the national trend that Mr. Hutchins referred to, particularly for the generation and transmission aspect of electric utility service. In some states today, electric utilities are required to obtain new generation by opening it to competitive bids. That offers benefits to consumers, and it lessens the need for regulation. Trend here and in many places is towards competition, not towards building a wall around service areas. The effect of this bill may very well be to deny Alaska citizens the benefits of competition in this industry, just as happened in the telephone industry. With that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jimmy, 6 years ago, I introduced in the House, and Senator, then, you know, I was in the House, Senator Frank introduced in the Senate the bill that would allow for intrastate telephone competition. And I was told by the then monopoly that that couldn't work, said we'd be paying for two plants or more in the state, and the customers would, because of that, would end up costing people more. To which I responded that I believe that costs would come down, service would improve, and revenues would likely increase probably for all carriers. I think that that my prediction came true, and I later talked to people at the staff level at Alaskom, and they were excited about the competition and about you know, what was happening in their company, and I'm guessing, even though I haven't gone back and looked at the numbers, that their revenues have increased, and they probably have a viable business, and I think because of that, GCI has grown. Is that, was my analysis correct in terms of revenues? I know the other two are correct.
I think it's certainly accurate in terms of our revenues. I am not positive whether or not it's accurate with Alaskom's revenues. If you took it to the national scene where the same thing happened, it would certainly be true of, for instance, both MCI's revenues and AT&T's revenues. If you listen to the guy who's the head of AT&T today, he would tell you this competition is the best thing that ever happened to AT&T. I cannot specifically speak for where Alaskom is in terms of its revenues.
No, it was must be good enough for AT&T to want it.
That's certainly true. And I think your analysis was exactly right. The monopolist will always come in and tell you that it can't work. And you've got competitors out there like GCI was, like Mr. Archon is today, saying it can work. I've got a better way of doing it. The commission is not just going to say, well, come on in, the door's wide open. They make you prove it's going to be better. Sometimes they make you prove it a little bit too much. I don't think people are going to come in demanding to put an extra set of wires down the street. That's probably very, very far off. But in other areas of the electric industry, it's certainly possible to have viable competition.
Jim Bert Sharp here. I'll just offer the comment that I don't know if they'll ever choose again to put wires down both sides of the alley in residential subdivision, but that was the case, as you well know, in Anchorage for a long period of time until they gave exclusive service areas and more or less forced service area exchange to consolidate service areas. So I've got a little bit of a problem with allowing competition to come in and cherry-pick the large profitable loads and leave the utility to struggle with how to justify supporting the smaller loads on a losing economy of size. And but I'm all for, if the commission wants to do that, then fine. I would be a strong supporter of deregulating the whole kit and caboodle. If we want competition, that's the way to go after it. If you don't want to guarantee a utility exclusive service area, well, then you don't need any regulation in my mind. Competition will take care of it. But I guess that's the other extreme. So that is going to be subject of a lot of debate, and whether that's the debate that's proper here for this yet narrow bill, which doesn't have anything to do with telephone companies, we'll see. As of this time. Senator Phillips.
I don't have a question, but I have a question for Dave.
Any more questions or comments to Jimmy Jackson? Thanks, Jim.
Thank you very much.
Senator Phillips.
Dave, I just want to find out if the CEA or MEA has got a position on this. I know that they're part of the association, but sometimes even utilities, electric utilities, differ among themselves, so I wanted to know. I wanted to know what the official position of Chugach Electric and Matanuska Electric, because they're the two I'm really familiar with.
Mr. Chairman, in response to the question from Senator Phillips, all I can tell you on that is that we've had a number of discussions at the association meetings over the last year that focused on this question. And at each meeting, both Matanuska Electric and Chugach Electric were represented, and there were no negative opinions expressed by any member of the association.
But there's nothing official from both those co-ops then, right, on this subject here?
I'm sure there's a position in support of this from Matanuska Electric. I'm not sure there's any official position from Chugach.
Any other questions, Mr. Hutchins? Thanks again, Dave. Is there anyone else from the audience that wants to testify on this bill at this time?
Teleconference.
Anyone else at teleconference sites other than the two that has had signed up that wish to testify? With that, we will set the bill aside for future consideration by the committee and move on to SB 5, an act prescribing the use and characteristics of voting booths employed in the election and the color of ballots used in state primary elections. I would ask the sponsor to say a few words. Do you want to? Okay, fine. Then state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Patricia Grenier, and I'm married to Senator Kelly. Senator could not be here today, so he sent me instead. This past election, many of the voters in Senator Kelly's district and throughout the state complained about two things: different colored ballots and the new curtainless suitcase voting booths. This legislation is designed to address these concerns by ensuring the secrecy of ballots and the privacy of voting in two ways: by requiring that half of all booths at each precinct be curtain booths, and by having all primary ballots printed on white paper only. As it stands now, the secrecy of voting in this state is severely compromised. There simply have not been enough curtained voting booths at all polling places. In fact, Senator Kelly's own precinct had just one curtained booth in the last election. As well, these new suitcase voting booths the division is utilizing have lower walls and no curtain, so that one can simply look over and see the ballot of the next voter. Finally, with the different colored ballots in the primary, a person carries their ballot and their stubs through the precinct, and when they wear their I have voted stubs, the selection of ballot is obvious and not private or secret. The ballot a voter chooses and how he or she casts their vote is a secret matter, not to be shared indiscriminately without consent. The secret ballot is one of the basic protections in a democracy. This legislation remedies these corruptions of the voting process and carries zero fiscal note. Thank you. I'm open for questions.
Questions from as many members?
I voted in the last election, and I wasn't even aware of the difference in color until somebody else brought it up, and then I said, "Oh, I was wearing that. You know, I voted. Have you or whatever that tag says." And
what color did you have?
Red.
I don't remember what color it was, but it was the.
It was different, right?
It was the one that would have had my name on it had my name been on it. But in our voting precinct, now that you brought it up, there were some places where, and I think I voted at a station that was not curtained. I thought it was different, but I wasn't particularly offended because there was nobody looking over my shoulder. And I went in there and knew how I was going to vote. I voted quickly, and they probably, even somebody, had they been looking from a distance, wouldn't have been able to tell. I agree with people being able to have their privacy. And I'm not sure why that change was made. I assume it's economy or something. And I think maybe this is a good option then to say in at least every voting station, at least one place is there where you can do that. I think the people in the voting precincts keep a pretty good tab on people so they're not being offensive and looking at others. And I've always felt that they've done a good job in our precinct. I'm sure it's the same case in other precincts. So it's probably a good idea to make some of these changes, but I'm not sure it's a big problem, at least not yet. But apparently it was to somebody.
What are your thoughts?
Well, it's a comment more than a question. I mean, looking at this bill last night, frankly, I didn't even know it was a problem. The biggest problem we had was changing the location of the voting place. That was the biggest complaint I got past election, aside from the closed primary. Where I voted, I was just trying to recall, in August and November, all of them had their curtains in my, where I'm voting at. So I'll have a few questions for division elections on that.
Yeah.
Maybe we stole them and you guys didn't get them.
Mr. Chairman, I see one other major change. We were changing from a election board, a person to an inanimate object, the chairman to a chair. I see that's throughout here, so that's probably a pretty important change.
I would ask, the differences. I think I see the differences between the work draft of the CS and the original bill. Is it just the last?
Yes. At the request of the election committee, we brought section 4, because it used which definition of voting booth we were going to use.
So the deletion of section 4 is from the original bill is the only difference in the any substitute draft. Any other questions? Thank you.
Oh, that brings up a question. Is there a definition now in statute on voting booth?
Yes, it is in section 1, line 11, 12, 13, 14, and line 15. Or line 1 on page 2, excuse me.
Okay, but previously the bill. Okay, so you had that, plus then you had a definition for voting booth, and there's...
That was already in the statute.
It says, it's amended by adding a new paragraph to read, so that apparently was not already in statute.
Oh,
new paragraph 37. It's which you've deleted.
Right,
because
correct.
The other definitions throughout here are satisfactory to define what a voting booth is.
Correct.
Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I have a motion to adopt the CS?
Mr. Chairman, I move the adoption of the CS for SB 5, and I guess we state affairs, draft 9-LS0075/F by Chenoweth 210-95.
Any objections? CS is hereby adopted. Senator Phillips, ask me a question.
Yeah, did you have, obviously Senator Lehman had some problems. I didn't see it in my own precinct. Granted, I got 9, 10 other precincts, which I didn't see, but did you have any problems in your own precinct on the curtains?
Not in our precinct. I helped put them up.
Oh.
So at least that was my only duty at that time. So I don't think there was a problem in the precincts. I didn't hear of any in Fairbanks, so... I think the only complaint was the different color of the ballots and so forth.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Lehman.
Maybe this question can be answered. In looking at this, I thought the problem with the colors dealt with the primary election, and yet this says doesn't have anything to do with the primary election ballot, and it says the director shall print the ballot on white paper as for the general election ballot. I'm not sure why we use those words in that order, but it's kind of a funny way to say it. But it
maybe we have division elections.
We do have.
Maybe they can define why. I thought the question really came down. People were having trouble with deciding who picked the Democrat, Green, and AIP ballot, and who picked the Republican ballot. Were there multicolored general election ballots?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lehman, no, there weren't. And I had a question on that, too. It was just the way the drafters put this together. Section 1525.060 deals with, Chapter 25 deals with primary elections, not general elections. But Senator Kelly specifically requested, they say, the primary election ballot shall be white, as the general election ballot is. But this is in the correct subject, this is area statutes. It deals with primary elections. This addresses primary elections, and this, if you look at this chapter 25, it's primary elections.
Jeff?
25 or 15?
1525 is primary elections. Oh, I see why they said the director shall print the ballot, the primary ballot, on white paper like the same as it is for the general election ballot.
As if it was the general.
Correct.
That's a dumb way to say it.
They should say as if.
How about the director shall print the ballot on white paper, strike the rest of it out, and place the names of all candidates?
He's in committee's discretion.
I mean, we're going to have people arguing over this one in the future. Go back to the record and see what Josh Fink said in committee. And
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lehman, if in fact that would be something that might slow this down, I'm sure the sponsor would be quite content if you struck that.
Let's go on and hear from a representative from the Division of Elections. They can shed some light on the recording or offer some advice. Please state your name and
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is David Koivunimi. It's spelled K-O-I, V as in Victor, U-N-I-E-M-I. I'm the acting director of the Division of Elections. Basically, I'm here to answer any questions. The Division of Elections neither supports nor opposes the provisions of SB 5.
Senator Phillips.
Dave, I know you're just getting back in the saddle after 4 years of retirement, if you want to call it that. Did you guys get any complaints on this?
We received some from Senator Kelly's office, for one.
Okay. How about other areas of the state?
It was mainly just in Anchorage proper, and I don't have any kind of a number, but we didn't get a significant number of complaints. What we do with the voting booths in Anchorage itself, we call it the blue suitcase type polling booth, and we only have 223 of those in Anchorage, and we have over 959 other types of polling booths in the Anchorage. What we try to do is, and we go out to contract and out to bid to have a private contractor set up the polling booths in Anchorage and deliver them around to all the polling places and everything. And in the specifications of the contract, we specifically state the vendor is responsible for the setup of all equipment at the polling place. There must be an even mix of different types of voting booths at each precinct. So if there was a problem, and apparently there was, at least in Senator Kelly's precinct, it wasn't for a lack of other types of polling booths. It was just that this precinct ended up having more of the suitcase type polling booth than the other types. But we try our best to have a mix of polling booths. Add as far as the deletion of the definition section, the problem with the definition section was that it said that they should be at least 6 feet tall, and that none of our handicapped polling booths are 6 feet tall, so we would have a problem. Would we have to replace all of our handicapped polling booths? But as far as the different color of the election ballots, Lieutenant Governor Ulmer wanted me to express to you that she was not happy with the different color of the primary ballot. She said, as far as she's concerned, it would never happen during her regime. But as far as if it's the desire of the legislature to put it into statute, that's fine. We don't intend to do that again. Basically, this is what the ballots look like, and at least some of the justification was that it would help the people who work at the polling places to reduce down confusion as to what ballots they give. You can see the ballots are stapled to this backing, and if we wanted to, what we could do is just have a white ballot and a different color on the stapled backing to avoid that type of confusion. That was what was done in the past, and I can't answer the question why it was done differently during this primary.
Senator Lehman.
Did you have a follow-up?
Go ahead, Lauren, I'll ask.
I just want to, is it important that the ballot be on white paper or for the primary, or just important that it be on one color of paper?
Well, I think the importance is just the one color.
Right. And
I think probably white paper is probably a little bit cheaper too, frankly.
So that's fairly common. I'm just thinking in terms of stock that may be available and price. It may be at some time appropriate to use buff or light blue like you had there. I don't know that it's really important. It's not important to me that it be on white paper. I think it's just important that it be on a single color, and that's probably the case with most people.
Well, white paper is what's specified for the general election, so you know the consistency is fine for the primary election because it's spelled out for as white paper for the general election. So okay. We don't have a problem with that.
Senator Phillips.
Real quick, Dave, do you know which areas of Anchorage you complaints were?
No, I don't. I could check with the Anchorage supervisor to see if she recalls what areas. Complaints about the polling booths or about the ballots?
No, well,
the ballots
are a universal complaint.
That's correct.
The booth, I'd like to know.
Okay.
Any other questions of Dave? Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Anyone else in the audience that cares to testify on this bill? Any further questions from the committee? It's a pleasure, committee.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just go ahead and move
you want to move this? I guess I'd just as soon at least offer an amendment. I think that now that I've looked at it, it makes sense, but at first blush it was a little confusing that on page 2, line 17, the director shall print the ballot on white paper, and then the phrase, as for the general election ballot, which seems to be out of place, a little confusing. I think we could probably delete those six words and still accomplish what we're trying to accomplish. Anybody who's looked at the rest of the statutes, is there any, there's no problem with that? We're not, I move that amendment.
So your amendment would be to change the wording to the director shall print the ballot on white paper and place the names.
Right.
Deleting from the word as through ballot on the second page.
Unless page there's something in the instructions for printing the general election ballot that there's something other than the white paper, it could have print or type size or other things on there that maybe that's what's being suggested here, and I don't know. That's just what I'm...
Quality of paper.
Maybe...
Quantity?
Bond.
Could be. If that's the case, then we probably should say, using the same standards or guidelines as for the general election ballot.
Which is just as complicated as which.
Anyone, any objections to the amendment as proposed? Well, shall read, the director shall print the ballot on white paper and place the names of all candidates, et cetera, et cetera. Any other comments? Amendments to the offer? That's a pleasure, committee.
Chairman, I move CSS B5 amended, or State Affairs, and ask to pass that one individual recs.
Any objection? So moved.
So moved.
With that, we'll move to SB 51, an act relating to income of the permanent fund and providing for an effective date. We have the sponsor, Senator Rieger. Senator Rieger, would you please come forward and give us a statement on SB 51?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Steve Rieger. I represent Senate District South Anchorage. Senate Bill 51 places into statute the concept of real earnings and applies that concept to the provisions for the uses of permanent fund earnings. There are several ways in which income of a fund, like the permanent fund or a pension fund, can be calculated. When all cash receipts are counted without regard to the effects of inflation, the earnings are often referred to as nominal earnings. In contrast, real earnings are the amount by which nominal earnings exceed inflation. For any long-term preservation of a fund, and particularly in times of any significant inflation, the concept of real earnings is extremely important to the management of an endowment fund. Any endowment which is designed to last for a sustained period of time must be concerned about its purchasing power and earning power. Inflation tends to erode a fund. To offset this, a fund must grow in nominal terms at the same rate as inflation just to preserve its purchasing or earning power. In this context, a fund can only afford to pay out earnings which are in excess of the rate of inflation, or real earnings. I believe that the voters, in establishing the permanent fund, intended for the fund to be truly permanent in the sense that its purchasing power and earning power should not be eroded over time. In this context, a real earnings approach is most appropriate for the permanent fund. The only money which should be put on the table for use each year is real fund earnings. In contrast, under the present Alaska statutes, all of the nominal earnings are put on the table for appropriation each year. The legislature then allocates the earnings to dividends, inflation proofing, and the earnings reserve account. With the passage of SB 51, the inflation proofing would be automatic, and the legislature would then provide for the allocation of real earnings between the dividends and the earnings reserve account. This will have a couple of effects. One, the effect on the permanent fund earnings reserve, since there would no longer be a need to reserve money in the earnings reserve account to cover a shortfall in inflation proofing, the required size of the permanent fund earnings reserve would be smaller, or at least not, it would not be as great. But there would be some reason to retain some amount in the permanent fund earnings reserve, because there is still a five-year averaging provision which could apply to the calculation of dividends. But this is only a mathematical calculation. Senate Bill 51 itself is silent on the issue of the permanent fund earnings reserve, and it doesn't require any change from present permanent fund earnings reserve policy. The effect on dividends is also one that was discussed last year when this bill was put forward. Senate Bill 51 leaves untouched the underlying formula for the calculation of dividends. As you all know, the formula for dividends is, in very rough terms, approximately half of earnings. However, since the earnings upon which dividends are based are real earnings instead of nominal earnings, the underlying formula will indicate a slower rate of growth of dividends, or even a temporary drop in the amount transferred to the dividend fund, depending on the permanent fund's actual investment performance in the next few years. And the permanent fund has done quite a number of runs using different assumptions of what that effect might be. But even at that, I want to point out that in actual fact, the legislature has appropriated the transfer to the permanent fund dividend account each year. There is a formula in statute which prescribes an amount, but the legislature actually does it as part of the budget. And the legislature retains that ability with the passage of Senate Bill 51. What Senate Bill 51 does do with respect to the dividends is that it's designed to deter an appropriation which is greater than the total real earnings performance of the fund. Another change, which is minor, is that the method of calculating inflation proofing is prescribed slightly differently. The basis for inflation proofing is prescribed based on the average outstanding balance of the fund for the year rather than the ending balance. And those are the significant changes that are prescribed in Senate Bill 51. Since I have the floor for a second, I want to point out that in looking at the real earnings or looking at the investment performance of the fund, the actual investment management of the permanent fund is critically important. And one of the things that the Budget and Audit Committee did the past 2 years was commission a study to look at asset allocation. They did it with a firm named Ibbotson Associates, which has a national good reputation. And they came out with a report which prescribed a changed asset allocation. And it's been my observation in tracking the permanent fund that they are moving in the same direction as the Ibbotson report is recommending. I believe that this will improve the longer term investment performance of the fund, and in turn improve the real earnings. Some of the runs, which the permanent fund did, are based on the long-term forecast that Ibbotson provided to the Budget and Audit Committee, as well as their own in-house standard forecast. And obviously, the Ibbotson representation is a better real earnings performance, and so the amount of money put on the table each year and what's showing the runs is a little bit different, a little bit actually bigger than what the standard permanent fund run is. With that, I'd like to answer questions and urge the committee's favorable consideration.
Senator Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rieger, I know that you've been reading the report of the Bipartisan Commission on Entitlement and Tax Reform. In it, it talks about, and I've heard it elsewhere, that the Consumer Price Index is probably overstated by as much as, I don't remember the number, it's either 0.5% or maybe 0.8% because of the basket, you know, and baskets are changing, and so they're probably going to go back and revise that, and that's going to make some differences, of course, lots of differences, because many things depend on adjustments according to the CPI. In light of that, I don't know if it'd be a revised one, do you think it's appropriate to continue using the CPI, or do you think what we ought to do is make sure that the Consumer Price Index really does reflect true inflation, or is there a better index to use?
I would say, since the actual use of permanent fund earnings isn't spelled out anywhere in any statute, you can't glibly answer what the right indexes should be, because if you knew what the fund was going to be used for, the earnings be used for, then you'd index your fund to that index. Since the only prescribed use right now is dividends, which go to consumers and they in turn use that dividend for some purpose or another, I suppose that the consumer price index is as good as index as any. And probably the best approach is to try to have the most accurate CPI and make use of that rather than try to change index to some other, because there are a lot of indexes out there, wholesale price index, manufacturer's cost index, I mean, there's a whole range, but I think CPI is as good as any, and the question is just whether it's an accurate measurement of true CPI.
Right, and maybe the key thing there is just to get CPI, if indeed it's overstated, if it overstates, is get them to change the process. Or I think the key thing is they need to keep changing the basket, because consumers' baskets, of products changes as people buy different things. Mm-hmm. There are things now that we buy that we didn't buy 15 years ago, like laptop computers, fax machines, and
legislators.
Pink salmon in a pouch. Get some of that.
Yeah.
Last thing. But I mean, there as product the product mix changes and consumers change with it. Apparently, it's the lag in the change that is causing it to be slightly overstated. At least that's what some people think.
Any other questions, Senator Rieger?
Mr. Chairman, I want to point out that this bill was, or this concept was recommended in the governor's transition report, I noticed, as noted in your packet, where they say pass legislation to automatically inflation-proof the permanent fund by distributing only real earnings for dividends. And I believe that it does make sense. And even though it was maybe an idea that emanated from one side of the aisle or the other, people have picked up on it, and it makes sense.
Any other questions of Senator Rieger? Just a clarification in my mind. This proposes, this would set in statute that the cost of living or the inflation proofing would be automatic and still have to be appropriated by the legislature.
But it's
it would be, mechanics would be, it shall be deposited, and then you go to the next step on determining if, when, and how much permanent fund dividend should be, and et cetera.
Well, this has been something that's been debated over the years. And I don't have it right in front of you, but basically the wording of the constitutional amendment says that the returns on the permanent fund shall be deposited in the general fund unless otherwise provided by law. And that's been argued at times that is a way where a mechanism such as the inflation proofing could be actually made automatic and bypass the legislative appropriation process. So it's not clear. I would think that in practice the legislature might put it in the front section anyway, but the idea is to not create a mistaken impression that there's more money available in any given fiscal year than there really should be. And it's to keep it off, out of the discussion and off the table, because I do fear that as money continues to get tight, there's going to be proposals to say, let's just do without inflation proofing for this year, and that's how we can make the other ends meet. And it would be it's that kind of dynamic which would shortchange the future generations that I'm trying to avoid in this bill.
Appreciate that. Any other comments by committee members? Thank you. We have Jim Kelly with the Less Permanent Fund Corporation here. I wish to say a few words on this legislation. Good afternoon, Jim.
Hi, Bert. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I will just say a few words. Jim Kelly's my name. I'm a research and liaison officer for the Permanent Fund Corporation. Board hasn't yet studied this bill. They're going to meet on the 24th. They'll tell you after that what their position is. Historically, the board is absolutely in favor of any proposals you all make that are going to have the effect of protecting the principle of the permanent fund. The first part of this bill certainly does that, and I'd be surprised if they weren't excited about it. The part that adjusts the dividend formula really isn't anything we'd get into. That's for you to decide whether or not you want to do it. I did a bunch of runs on it. I did about 24 different runs, and you know, there's a ton of numbers. And I was thinking about it today, and trying to figure out what was really important about what I learned from going through that exercise. And one of the things I learned, whether you adopt Senate Bill 51 or you keep the status quo, really what you're looking at from the permanent fund in terms of real $95 for the next 15 years or 20 years. Income that you can use after you take care of inflation. Given our projections for rates of return, is something on the order of $600 to $700 million year in, year out. That's how much money you're going to have to spend for dividends or anything else in today's dollars. If you accept the projections of Ibbotson and increase the rate of return above what we think, you know, we conservatively estimate. Maybe that goes from 600 to 700 to 750 to 800 a year. If you if inflation drops a percent, that's probably worth another $150 million. If it goes up a percent, you know, it's going to cost you $150 million. Under the status quo, that $600 or $700 million over the long term basically is going to be used for dividends. Under Senate Bill 51, half of it would be there for dividends, and the other half you could appropriate for dividends. You could leave it in your earnings reserve account. You could add it to principal. You could spend it on the government. If you spend it on the government, it's the same thing as paying it out in dividends. You're still going to end up with $600 or $700 million a year from the permanent fund to solve your problems in the future. It's not going to get any bigger than that. If you pay it out in dividends, it's the same thing. The only way that amount of money is going to get any larger is either A, we earn more money because the markets are kinder and our asset allocation is as, you know, as good as it can get, or the permanent fund gets bigger. The permanent fund only gets bigger either A, you cut the size of the dividends and you take that money and you put it into the permanent fund, B, you take some other money and put it into the permanent fund. One last point I wanted to make is that, just to answer your question about would it be automatic. In the early years, inflation proving happened automatically. The legislature didn't appropriate it. That was the interpretation. About midway through the Cooper administration, they decided to stick it in the front section of the bill. That, you know, it could go either way. However, I imagine it probably would end up in the front section of the bill in the future. As to any changes in CPI, if they change the CPI, it'll affect us, and we'll just live with it, and that's fine. We like to use the CPI because it's a number people can relate to, and we like to keep it simple so people can understand their permanent fund. The one change that Senator Rieger would make to inflation proofing and base it, see, we take the inflation rate and we multiply it times the number at the end of the year, and that's what inflation proofing is. And he would change it to basing it on the previous calendar year average, which would be a smaller number. So that would cost somewhere around, I don't know, $3 to $5 million a year in the amount that we would inflation proof. We'd just assume if you wanted to use an average balance, I'd just assume it'd be an average balance of the fiscal year rather than the calendar year, and use the consumer price index for the fiscal years as well. So it'd be a little bit more up to date. It wouldn't be so behind. That's basically it.
Well, I'm thinking of average balance, either at the end of the year or the average balance for the preceding year. Is that the cost or is that the market value as a given time?
It's done at cost right now.
Okay. That's what I thought until it's sold. It's not very
right. Which hurts us too.
There we go.
Jim, permanent fund board, are they going to look at this bill and make recommendations, or are they just going to look at it and then?
I expect them to make a recommendation on that part that they have a fiduciary responsibility to, which is protecting the fund. It does relate to that.
Will it be an endorsement or non-endorsement then? Right, it'll be something formal saying
yes.
We endorse this or we
yes.
don't. Okay. That's fair.
Any other questions, Mr. Kelly?
Chairman.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Any other people in the audience who cared to? It's the only ones I had signed up. Anyone that wants to testify that didn't get a chance to sign up on this bill at this time?
No.
Okay. We'll hold on to this bill, and we will work with the sponsor to get some information from the Permanent Fund Board by the end of the month, which is very shortly, and proceed from there. Senator Lehman.
I guess I could talk with Senator Rieger on my own, but I'd like a response to that, the last comments about changing calendar year to fiscal year and that impact. So maybe you don't need to do it today, but as we discuss it, I mean, unless you're prepared to do it today, but at some time I'd like to at least hear a discussion on that.
Why are you holding this because of the state? Hmm? Holding this bill because of the state? You want to do it that way? But
sure.
Okay.
Last time I exceeded
it. Yeah, I understand that. So that'll be the 24th. Then have
this
a meeting
week.
On the 25th. Well, yeah, it's 10 days from now.
We'll we'll continue working with the sponsor on this and see what. His feeling is on getting an opinion from the PFC board at this stage, at this committee level, or what's his desires. And we will keep this as a pending legislation that has previously been heard and available
Chairman.
To us on Tuesday.
Maybe I'm putting the sponsor on the spot, but, you know, it's his bill. I'd like to get his reaction.
Sure.
I mean, is that just a senatorial courtesy, actually, or anything else?
Reaction to...
Well, whether to wait or send this bill up to finance and then wait for the 24th for the permanent fund people. Of course, then there's a problem Senator Duncan wanting to hear it, so he's got that right as well. Hate to put you on the spot, Senator, but
well,
I'd like to get your opinion.
I think that it's important to remain to retain the goodwill of the chairman of this committee, since he's one of my votes on Senate finance.
Me too.
And yours too. But if the chairman wants to hold it for a couple weeks, I do want to see the bill pass, but I don't know if 2 weeks will
okay, that's what I really asked.
I'd really like to see it move forward because it's a significant bill, and it's one that it still has to get through this side and the other side.
Well, that's the real question. Do you think you had enough time?
That's no. I want to see the bill move forward and vote for a vote as early as possible. Hopefully, on the floor, if you can count enough noses to get that done. I really not locked in either way. Senator Duncan would like to have at least one more.
My understanding is we're not going to move today. I'd prefer to hear from fund boards, new boards, new people down there. It's my last opportunity to hear the bill. I don't think that we're going to adjourn in the next 3 or 4 weeks. We'll be around to fight the bill through.
Don't count on it, Jim. No. It follows the whole legislature. As Rick would say.
Let's hold the bill till Tuesday and give us time to think on it and see. Do we want to do that?
I just wanted to give you the...
No, that's fine. And it's in response to Senator Lehman's, my first reaction is that probably fiscal year is the right thing because earnings are calculated on the fiscal year and you might as well have the balance of the fund be the same time period. I want to think that through, but I think it's one of those glitches that no one had ever thought of before, that there was a six-month divergence between the inflation proofing and the earnings.
And then I guess the other, Mr. Chairman, just looking at the difference in end of year and the average, I mean, as long as you're looking at it, at least give some thought to that, and you may still stay with the average.
I just wanted to give you a look at it. So,
yeah, my gut feeling is I'd like to see the deposit into the corpus of it as be as large as possible for inflation proofing, and if that's 3 or 4 million or whatever more, if that proves that way, I would like to at least know that for sure and make that consideration on a possible change that you might be willing to make. But by no means are you losing my goodwill on this bill, I'll tell you that for sure.
Okay.
Any other comments?
I was just going to comment when Senator Duncan was saying we might not be out, we might be out of here in a month. I said, if he's as well behaved on the floor as he is in this committee, then we might be able to be out of here in a month.
What I say is, I don't think we will be. I think there's plenty of time for adequately here to go on this committee and on the floor.
Right.
I think that's a courtesy to give to all Senate members. I mean, this is an important bill. Verna Fund Corporation is, I think, needs to have a position on this bill. I think it's important to have the first committee referral. And I think Senator Reed would probably like to have a good deal of mine and others on the floor by being sure it's probably heard in the committee system, too.
Don't take me wrong. I was complimenting you on how well-behaved you were today.
resting.
We have a reputation in this committee that we just plod along and move forward all the time. My other feeling is that we are absent a member, and I'd like Senator Donnelly to at least have a chance to offer some comments on it. And he will get that opportunity if he desires to at least study it and be here on Tuesday. And we'll see what happens then. But
Mr. Chairman, if you're going to bring it back on Tuesday, I don't know what the sense of holding it then, because my understanding is the
24th.
Board doesn't meet until the 24th. Is that correct?
Yep.
24th.
Yes.
24th is Tuesday. Tuesday is the.
It's 10 days.
24th is next Friday. Week from Friday.
10 days from now will be Friday, I think.
Yeah, well, Tuesday's not the 24th, and the new executive director's not on board.
He's going to start the 27th.
He's going to start the 27th. The board's going to meet on the 24th, right?
No, my comment was that Senator Donnelly will be back for the Tuesday meeting, and I will inform him what has transpired and get active in if he wants to. And I'm sure the Permanent Fund is sensitive to every legislator as well as constituents, and we want to make sure that everybody gets a chance to offer their collective individual wisdom on this bill.
You got Jim's.
Meeting adjourned.